Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Each year, USDA puts out a rural development report looking at what's going on in the rural economy.
This year's edition of that report had some positive news.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack telling a Senate Ag Appropriations panel Tuesday that according to that report,
it appears that rural employment is now back to pre-pandemic levels. It appears that the poverty rate is significantly reduced. The unemployment rate is at an historic low in rural America. And in fact, we've actually seen a reduction in counties that have been characterized as persistently poor. These are counties that have experienced a poverty rate of 20% or more for over 30 years.
Vilsack said 29 counties have dropped out of that list over the last year, showing that efforts to rebuild rural economies are working. Gary Crawford, Washington.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
China is not working with clean load either.
Idaho Senator Mike Crapo on Thursday, floor of the Senate, talking about his and Joe Manchin's bipartisan legislation to defund EPA's rule designed to phase out gas-powered cars and trucks in favor of EVs.
As my colleague from Wyoming talked about, they're putting out unclean load in the terms of this debate every single day at massive amounts higher than ours. So what are we going to do? We're going to make the United States vehicle industry dependent on China. We're going to make the United States citizens who drive cars and trucks dependent on China and reduce our economic independence from China's anti-competitive pressures. That's what this debate really is about. The EPA's rule is the most aggressive form of tailpipe emission standard ever crafted and imposes a de facto electric vehicle mandate on the American people. Under the rule, automakers must decrease their average fleet-wide emissions by more than 50%, down from the current 192 grams of CO2 per mile to just 85 grams per mile in less than 10 years. In order to be compliant, the only way that these standards could possibly be met is through the mass production and adoption of electric vehicles, a fact of which the Biden administration and the Biden EPA is well aware. Once again, increasing our reliance on China. The rule effectively regulates gas-powered vehicles, cars and trucks, out of the marketplace, which, make no mistake, is the goal of this administration. As a result of the rule, internal combustion engines, or ICE vehicles, which still represent the overwhelming majority of new car sales in the United States, can make up no more than 30% of the new sales by 2032, if automakers are even able to be compliant with these standards. The rule represents yet another attempt by the Biden administration to use the rulemaking process to force its costly climate agenda on Americans and pick winners or losers in our free market. These emission standards go too far and will restrict affordable vehicle choices for families, harm U.S. businesses, degrade our energy and national security, and hand the keys of our automotive industry over to China, which currently dominates the entire electric vehicle supply chain and has no intention of reducing the carbon intensity of its economy anytime soon. The personal decision of what a consumer chooses to drive should not be made by Washington, let alone by circumventing Congress. I urge my Republican colleagues and my Democrat colleagues to join me in voting yes on this legislation to prevent American taxpayer dollars from being used to implement, administer, or enforce this disastrous EPA rule.
Similar rule had already passed the House, went for a vote on Thursday afternoon.
Is there a sufficient second? There appears to be. The clerk will call the roll.
Ms. Baldwin, Mr. Barrasso, Mr. Bennett, Mrs. Blackburn, Mr. Blumenthal, Mr. Booker, Mr. Bozeman, Mr. Braun, Mrs. Britt.
Needed 60 votes, only received 52. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News, now. Agriculture Today.
I think members of this committee would probably agree with me that one of the major responsibilities, certainly not the only one, is for the USDA to work in concert with the Congress to advance the economic well-being of our rural areas.
Is rural America a priority for the administration? USDA's Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
And certainly the key to that is the economic health and well-being of our farmers, ranchers, and producers. The reality is in the last 2 years, we've experienced record levels of net cash income in farm income. But not all, or for that matter, many, have benefited from that record level of income. In fact, the ERS recently reported that nearly half of our farmers over the last several years have not made any money at all, and that roughly 40% of farmers have made money, but the majority of money they make actually comes from off-farm income. So that means that the top 10%, those who sell more than $1 million of product, have done quite well. And they should, because they're extraordinary farmers, ranchers, and producers. But I think we have to focus as well on the 90% that haven't fared as well. The president likes to talk about rebuilding the middle class from the bottom up and the middle out, and I think we have a classic opportunity here as we discuss the farm bill to do just that. I think we have two choices that confront us. We can either get big or get out, as Secretary Perdue once suggested, or we can build more new and better markets, providing entrepreneurial opportunities for that 90% so that they benefit beyond just simply selling livestock and crops and government payments. I think we have a new opportunity. As a result of resources that are available to the Department of Agriculture, we've worked very hard to expand value-added opportunities, to create an opportunity for our farmers to take full advantage of emerging ecosystem markets where they're paid for the environmental result that they can achieve on their farms, looking for ways in which they can convert agricultural waste into ingredients for bio-based products, like sustainable aviation fuel, working to establish a local and regional food system which complements our production agriculture system, and working, of course, to take full advantage of the opportunities to embrace renewable energy on the farm and to provide that to their community. Mr. Chairman, these are real opportunities for us to expand more new and better markets and to create an entrepreneurial surge in rural places.
Of course, Vilsack says these rural issues are not new.
Now, this is not a new issue and not a new challenge. In fact, in 1979, then Secretary Bob Berglund came to this committee and essentially talked about the same issue. And in fact, it goes all the way back to the beginning of this department. If you look at the first report of the Commissioner of Agriculture, at the time, a fellow by the name of Isaac Newton, not the real Isaac Newton, Commissioner Isaac Newton, in his preface to a 632-page report that he made to the President on the first year of the Department of Agriculture, he mentioned the concern about the consolidation of real estate in the hands of a few. So this is an issue we've been dealing with for quite some time. But I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful that as we work together to fashion a farm bill, that we indeed can create real opportunities for small and mid-sized farming operations. Because when they survive and when they thrive, it means that there are more people living in rural communities. With more people, we can keep those schools open. We can expand hospital and healthcare opportunities. We can create new opportunities, new customers for those small businesses that are so vital to a small community. So this is, a significant and pivotal and transformational moment for this committee, and we look forward to working with you.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As we think about spring calving operations and typically early April being about the time of the year we're ready to start turning out bulls or starting our AI program. And so we just talked about the pros and cons of heat synchronization itself and the potential it lends itself to for the sake of doing artificial insemination work.
Oklahoma State beef breeding specialist Dr. Mark Johnson.
Artificial insemination permits us to use bulls that are genetically elite and can potentially improve our profit in raising a set of calves relative to our intended marketing endpoint. And so, as opposed to a natural service sire, the opportunity to go to a bull stud and actually pick out a bull and purchase semen that we know has got a little extra genetic merit to add to some of that value of a calf crop is a great thing. Where we get into those decisions on whether or not it's practical for us to AI and capitalize on that tends to get back to the whole concept of heat synchronization. Bringing a cluster or a sizable group of our cows into standing heat at the same time. And as a result of that, breeding them as a group, whether it's AI or naturally, permits us to look ahead into a calving season where we're going to have more calves born earlier in the calving season. And for the sake of our cow herd, we're going to end up with a cow herd that is more uniform in terms of what stage of gestation length that they're at a given time. And so for the sake of managing, vaccinating a set of calves and adding value to a set of calves, we end up weaning an older, heavier, and more uniform set of calves as a result of more of them born early in that calving season. For the sake of managing the cow herd, if all cows are pretty much in sync relative to stage of pregnancy, it's easier to manage both from a nutritional standpoint and a herd vaccination standpoint. And so we always get back to the reality that a short calving season is a benefit in a cow-calf operation with respect to management and adding value to calves. So what are some of the things we need to consider? Big things as we look at a breeding season and heat synchronization is, regardless of what protocol we use to actually synchronize the cows, it's going to require a minimum of 2 trips through a chute. We're going to have the manpower and the labor to actually sort on a set of cows, process a set of cows a couple of times. If we add artificial insemination onto that, that's at least one more time through the chute in order to get AI bred. Now, heat synchronization permits us to concentrate those efforts into a few days or maybe a few weeks. But at the same time, heat checking is going to require several hours, morning and night, during that stretch of time when the cows are coming in heat. The cows that are in heat that we're going to be breeding about 12 hours later are going to have to be caught, contained. And so we're going to have the facilities and the labor in order to do that as we look at heat synchronization and potential AI. One of the other things that we get into that we got to consider, do we have a good AI technician available if we want to do artificial insemination? A lot of times we connect the dots on the other part of this management plan. We get right down to the point that we're ready to AI cows. We want to schedule that. We want to have an AI technician that's available and ready. And in some cases, depending on the size of your herd, it's not just AIing a handful of cows of a given morning or at night, but we may be literally going through dozens of cows, maybe sometimes hundreds of cows. And the AI process itself takes a special skill set and is going to consume some time there. So those are the basic pros and cons and things to think through. Again, synchronization of the heat cycle, getting more cows bred earlier in the breeding season and more calves born earlier in the calving season is a big benefit.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Back in 2015, the Obama FCC implemented the regulatory regime the Biden FCC is planning to impose starting tomorrow.
South Dakota Senator John Thune on the floor of the Senate on Thursday.
This opened the door to a whole host of new internet regulations, including price regulations. And broadband investment declined as a result. That was a problem for Americans generally, who benefit when the United States is at the forefront of internet growth and expansion. And it was particularly bad news for Americans in rural states like South Dakota. Deploying broadband to rural communities already has a number of challenges, and adding utility-style regulations not meant for today's broadband market acted as a further disincentive to expanding access. Recognizing the chilling effect the Obama FCC's regulations were having on internet innovation and expansion, in 2017, the FCC, under Chairman Pai, voted to repeal the heavy-handed net neutrality regulations passed by the Obama FCC. The prospect was greeted with absolute hysteria from Democrats. You would have thought that the sky was about to fall, so dire were their predictions. We were told that the internet, as we know it, would disappear, that providers would slow speeds to a crawl, that we would get the internet word by word, that our freedom of speech was threatened. But the repeal went into effect. And guess what happened? Lo and behold, none of the Democrats' dire predictions came to pass. As anyone who's been on the internet lately knows, the internet has not just survived, but thrived. Innovation has flourished. Competition has increased. The Internet remains a vehicle for free and open discourse. And Internet speeds have not only not slowed down, they've gotten faster and faster. So where, I might ask, is the problem that requires this new onerous regulatory regime? Well, there isn't one. But unfortunately, that's rarely enough to stop Democrats who seem to lose sleep at the thought of some aspect of society not being subjected to heavy-handed federal regulation. In fact, of course, the federal government already regulates the Internet, but it does so using a light-touch regulatory approach that has allowed the Internet to flourish. The Biden FCC should be focused on addressing real challenges, such as continuing our efforts to close the digital divide and to ensure that every American has access to high-speed broadband. But as the three-year crisis at our southern border demonstrates, the Biden administration tends to ignore the real problems facing Americans in favor of expanding government and advancing its far-left agenda. And so I expect that the FCC will vote next week to impose this heavy-handed new regulatory regime. But while the vote may be a foregone conclusion, I am hopeful that the Biden FCC's regulations will be struck down in court. And I will do everything I can here in Congress to overturn them. Because if the new Biden regulatory regime is left in place, it may not be long before we'll be looking at the very opposite of net neutrality.
Critics still concerned it will slow the process of bringing high-speed broadband to rural areas. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Secretary Vilsack, you've identified in several letters the potential harms of some of the concerns and the cuts that have been recommended by the other side to cut domestic discretionary spending.
Ranking member of the Subcommittee on Ag Appropriations, Sanford Bishop, with Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
One of the plans wants to revert back to the FY22 levels, and others are saying just reduce it by 22% or more. You sent an excellent letter, which is available on the Appropriations Democrats website, which identified the devastating impacts on WIC, the Food Safety and Inspection Service, rural rental assistance, conservation operations, technical assistance that's provided to our producers, and the Farm Service Agency loans to farmers. The full committee ranking member and I will, I'm sure, explore the impact of these cuts during the question and answer period. At a time when it's possible that your 2024 request will be sharply attacked in the House bill, I think that members need to think about what could be lost under that scenario. Notable investments in the requests that virtually every member of the subcommittee supports include an increase of $105 million to help secure our watersheds, 400 more staff in rural development, increasing the funding for single-family housing loans, an increase in the Guaranteed Business and Industry Loan Program, an increase in water and waste funding that's desperately needed by so many rural communities across America, $52 million for the ReConnect Program, $550 million for the Agriculture and Food Research Initiative, better known as AFRI. While we hear some support for drastic cuts, I don't think we will hear much criticism of increases such as these in the budget. To my friends on the other side of the aisle, you can't have it both ways. Either these or the many other programs in our bill are worthy, or they should be funded at the necessary level to do their jobs for the American people, or they are not.
Vilsack says doing some of these things is a slippery slope.
I think that there are many challenges with that notion. And I think it's important to understand what we're not trying to do is to stigmatize people that are struggling financially. We're talking about senior citizens, people with disabilities. That's a challenge. It's a challenge from a technology standpoint, and it's a challenge in terms of stigma. I think what we're trying to do is make sure that people understand that they have the capacity, and we want to give them additional resources and incentives to make the right choices. We want to trust the consumer.
Vilsack continues to get questions on his use of the Commodity Credit Corporation Funds, or CCC.
I think it's important to understand that the Commodity Credit Corporation was established at a time of great crisis in this country, and it was established to provide flexibility to the department to be able to respond to challenges. We have a challenge both in terms of climate and in terms of the inequity and distribution of profit and income within the agricultural economy. We can't have 90% of our producers not making money or not making the majority of their money from farming operations. So how are you going to do that? What are you going to do for those 90%? One way you can help them is by creating a more value-added proposition, creating a different market, a new commodity. And that's essentially what USDA did, and it's essentially what the charter of the Commodity Credit Corporation provides for.
Is that what the industry was asking for, the
industry,
farmers?
Every major commodity group was begging for this.
These
begging
are people
for this.
Who produce our food and fiber?
Correct. They're not special interests, in my view. They're the people we represent and work for.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
When we're talking about any long-term investment, one of the first things we're going to talk about is feasibility.
Eric DeVeest is an Oklahoma State Extension Farm and Ranch Management Specialist. Are replacement heifers worth the cost?
Is there enough cash to make this happen? And so with replacement heifers, with the prices we're looking at now, most of our guys are looking at borrowing money to make that happen. And so they're not going to be what we call self-liquidating, meaning the calves that you're selling off of those replacement heifers and the culled heifers cows won't generate enough revenue to make your principal and loan payments after you pay for feeding those animals. So that means cash has to come from somewhere else. So if we're looking at an operation that already has tight cash flow, purchasing heifers and borrowing the money to do it is only going to make that situation worse. They're going to be more financially stressed. So you've got to find cash from other sources to pay that for those heifers, pay the loan on them. And if cash is already tight, it's not going to get easier. It's only going to get more difficult.
So we move from just looking at the cost to what we can get paid for. The markets, will they be a deciding factor?
The next thing we talk about would be advisability. So is this over time projected to be profitable? And there's a good chance that that's true, but it's not just that longer term profitability. We also have to look at the added financial risk put on the business when you spend a lot of cash and take on a lot more debt, what that does to the firm's financial ratios. Debt to equity, debt to asset, current ratio. So we're talking about using up a lot of cash reserves from the business and a lot of the credit reserve that that business has. So if, as you say, we spend the money, a farmer spends the money on that, borrows the money, and all of a sudden prices fall. So if we go back to 2014, prices were really strong for cattle. And so a lot of guys were buying replacement heifers, and $4 a pound was not uncommon at that time for replacement heifers. Prices were solid into 2015. Then 2016, prices fell back to earth. And those guys that spent all that money on high-priced heifers in 2014 were not going to make money off of those heifers. So what we're talking about really is risk. You've got a lot of financial risk associated with borrowing money. And if you're already in a tough financial position, your debt to asset, debt to equity, current ratio, et cetera, are in moderate to poor shape, buying those heifers is only going to make things worse and make you increase your exposure to risk from prices, from drought, from disease. And so the short of it is keep risk in mind. Leave space for risk. So you might not want to fill up the pastures just yet.
So speaking of not filling up pastures, what are other options?
If you decide not to buy as many heifers as what you think your pastures are going to carry, so you're short stocked, there are a lot of options for that forage. You can wean calves, put them back on stockpiled forage. You can stockpile that forage to run your stock farther into the fall and winter and put fewer groceries out there, hay. You can lease out pastures. You can bale pastures, although financially that might be the worst of the options. But there are options available to you. You can still generate cash off of pastures that you don't put more breeding stock on. So, and it, in many cases, will be lower risk to do that.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Western Water and Working Lands Initiative is an initiative focused on six strategies, 13 different ways in which we approach preserving groundwater, surface water, focused on preserving rangeland, pasture land, agricultural productivity, and the tools to do so.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on work being done through the Western Water and Working Lands Initiative.
In fiscal year 23, we invested $1.9 billion across a variety of programs within USDA. You saw aggressive use of EQIP, CSP, RCPP within the NRCS. You saw research being conducted at ARS as well as grants in NIFA. We work collaboratively with our partners in the federal government, focused on everything from storage to more conservation and better utilization of the scarce water resources we have.